Welcome to yet another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, exploring the cultures of consciousness, which I was certainly doing last weekend when I went to the Fare Thee Well Grateful Dead shows at the monstrous Levi's Stadium in Santa Clara, California. I first saw the Dead in Ventura County Fairgrounds, Southern California, in 1983, and it was quite an experience being in this space with all of these crazy wild hippies. I'd have to give the crowd a solid A+ for the weekend. The band, well, let's say they kind of moved between a sort of B- zone on Saturday to a kind of solid B+ and occasionally A- zone on Sunday night, I was happy to say. But it was extraordinary, even when the music completely fell apart on Sunday a few times. I'm not a non-critical Grateful Dead fan. It was remarkable to think about whatever it was that caused a stadium full of 75,000 people to show up at a space where it was possible for the musicians to fall on their face, in the sense that the Dead's commitment to a certain kind of unique improvisation and a certain situation of mutual listening and mutual strife is deeply bound up with the fact that the Dead could be the experience that it is for so many people, which at times was about as close as I ever come to throwing myself fully into a genuine church service with, you know, crowds of hundreds, you know, tens of thousands of people singing along to songs with multiple meanings that have existential, spiritual, and hedonistic implications that dance and sway with one another. And more importantly, even than the tunes, is, of course, the dancing. I did what I've always done at Grateful Dead shows, which is to wander around most of the time, finding little pockets of excellent hippie dancing and diving in. And my efforts were greatly rewarded. And so I came away from the weekend with a renewed sense of American culture's potential to weave together music, improvisation, nebulous spirituality, language and lyrics that resonate both with American historical materials and with the more poetic possibilities of sense and nonsense, and particularly with what a great sense of fun of all that and how much also I needed it. It's been a kind of a rough last few weeks. The world has seemed all too with me, and it was remarkable to walk away from that experience realizing how rejuvenating, enlivening, enlightening, and amusing this cross current of music, spirituality, the body, and the cosmic mind can be. And this is all by way of preface to our conversation today, which will engage these issues, though in the in a distantly related but certainly singular zone of jazz music. I would never say that the Grateful Dead was jazz music, although it has its jazzy elements, and they have played with jazz players on occasion, Ornette Coleman and Branford Marsalis being the most notable. Nonetheless, Jason Bivens' new book, Spirits Rejoice, Jazz and American Religion, plunges into pretty much all the themes that I've mentioned so far. It's a really wonderful and valuable book, and it's been a great book for me because I've just been getting into jazz again. I go through phases, and this time it's been a pretty serious bout of study. And one of the reasons that I have been listening so intently of late is because jazz provides a remarkable offering which is the ability to go through the archive of the 20th century and to key into certain themes, musical, spiritual, cultural, racial, American, and see those things develop, change, grow, dissolve through the median of or the mediation of singular individuals and, more importantly, perhaps singular collectives. And, you know, there's a great deal to be said about jazz, and there's a great deal that has been said about jazz. But one thing that hasn't been explored that much is precisely the relationship of jazz and American religion. And this means American religion in the broadest sense. And one of the great things about Jason's book is that he has a capacious and complex understanding of both jazz and American religion, and that both of these expansive, constantly renegotiating fields are interacting in his text. And I walked away with from reading it with the sense not only that American religion is inextricable from the history of jazz, but that if you want to understand American religion, and particularly the alternative, experimental, cosmic, mystical, and weird aspects of American religion, which, as regular listeners of this show know, is one of my fortes, then you can do no better than listening to deeply and openly to the history of jazz in the United States, which of course also features the, you know, remarkably instructive and amazing experience of encountering, you know, a mostly African American cultural tradition that allows a great deal of information to be passed and expressed in ways that language often gets in the way. So it's been a remarkable trip and a remarkable timing with Jason's new book, Spirits Rejoice. So I'm really glad to bring Jason Bivens onto the show. Well, one last thing, he is a professor of religion at North Carolina State University, and he's also a guitarist. I think he started out with punk bands in D.C. and then now does improvisation and jazz. Maybe we'll talk about that later on. But Jason, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thank you, Eric. What a great introduction, too.
Yeah. It's really been a nice time, and I've really had a blast reading your book. And I also wanted to say before we start the conversation, as part of a plug, that it serves two different functions for me, or for someone who's learning more about jazz. Is on the one hand, you provide a lot of short sections that look at individual players, which enable us to learn something about that particular player and their own unique relationships to religion. And I, for one, found out that many players that I had listened to that, you know, maybe they had an interesting song title here or there, were much, much deeper into theosophy or African religion or baptism than I knew. So that was great. But then you also, particularly in the second half of the book, move more into issues of phenomenology, issues that would be interest of to people, even if they're not particularly engaged with jazz as a genre or history. You go into some questions about meditation, the role of sound, the role of collectivity, the role of improvisation as a place to negotiate experience, both religion and then the sort of cosmic or spiritual forces that religion in some ways is itself a kind of net. So it's really you have a number of different tactics there, and then the writing itself is very sprightly and engaging. And so I think I wanted to start out actually with just the title, because you use Spirits Rejoicing as a very as a concept that you've, you know, a term that you've drawn from the tradition to perform very specific things in your writing as a way of, frankly, avoiding other kinds of words that have their own baggage. So I would like to hear you dive in. And what is it about Spirits Rejoice and Spirits Rejoicing that helps key into this special node between jazz and American religion?
Yeah, I think you really hit on it with this, the goal of avoiding a certain kind of conceptual, and I have to say also historical baggage. I'm not trying to shirk language entirely, clearly, because spirits rejoicing as a gerund clearly invites a kind of relationship with the term spirituality. But I think it was in the interplay of the nebulous and the particular that the term really kind of grabbed me, coming as it does initially from Albert Eiler's incredible kind of out of the gates 1964 recording of the same name. There was something about the elliptical nature of the term, but also the way in which the terms, in which the second half of the term rejoice functions in Eiler's own life narrative, you know, coming as he did out of this specifically African-American Protestant cultural matrix and playing against the kind of deep socioeconomic and racial sorrow as he did, I found it provocative to think about that almost defiant rejoicing that Eiler sought to model and also cultivate. I thought it interesting to think about that as a kind of model for improvisation more broadly. But I think in terms of the conceptual tracks the term enabled me to lay down, it really was avoiding too much overhang from the term religion, as valuable as that is as a scholar. It really does lead to some blind alleys as much as anything else.
Yeah, and as to spirituality, I mean, that's one of the, my whole life I feel like I've been trying to, work my way through and between, terms like religion and spirituality, which of course is in the conventional understanding for a lot of people is, religion is the institution, it's the dogma, it's the structure, and spirituality is the individual, da da da. And of course, if you start looking at the history or the facts on the ground, these two zones blur into one another. And because they're also both bound up with politics and consumerism in so many ways that to get at something else, something beyond, something that troubles these categories, it's sometimes really hard to do. And one of the great invitations of your book that you make really explicit at the end is that listening and music, and particularly music that does not rely heavily on lyrics or even song titles, that listening offers us a way to move into these spaces that are less marked by very concrete, historically determined words. And so it's an invitation not just to kind of experience or expand our own sensibility, but also to understand how religion operates in a different way. But another way we could just go through is to talk a little bit more about Eiler. I mean, one of the things about Albert Eiler that when I kind of sort of tuned into him, that was sort of that opened up something for me, was recognizing that despite the aggressiveness of the avant-garde gestures of the time of moving outside of, inherited forms from bebop or bop, that there's this kind of, move that you have in that time in the early 60s towards this radical dissolution through Coltrane, et cetera, et cetera. And so in a way, it's an extremely avant-garde move, very edgy, experimental, challenging, all those words we've inherited from the historical avant-garde. Mm-hmm. But with Eiler, there's something also incredibly, in the best sense of the term, simple, in the sense that there's this kind of, again, the words don't quite work, purity or a kind of immediacy, a sort of lack of self-consciousness that totally changed my listening once I kind of got it, because it had to do with something much more basic, if you will, or available on some level, even though he had to sort of find it in his way. And then as a person, I mean, his personality, his pretty tragic story also seemed to show someone who was not, in some ways, a manipulator, sophisticated, a games player. He was someone who was kind of open to the spirit in those terms, and it really comes through the music. And I'd like to hear more from you about, why Eiler? What is that? You've explained this term, but there's got to be something about him too that sheds a particular light on your thesis.
Absolutely. You mentioned a little bit about this in the biographical intro, but just as a person and as a thinker, I'm very attracted to, I wouldn't myself call call it marginality, although that's what culture calls it, I think. But I'm interested in self-cultivation. I'm interested in aesthetic chance-taking and so forth. And as a guy who grew up in the 1980s and early 1990s in kind of punk and post-punk musical circles, I encountered the avant-garde first by rumor. And I'd heard about figures like Eiler and Coltrane and Cecil Taylor long before I'd actually heard their music, the exception being Coltrane, because that was pretty easy to come by. And when I first heard Albert Eiler, like you, Eric, I was struck by, I think, maybe the discrepancy between my expectations, which were, I thought I was going to hear this furious kind of volcanic, cavalcading, note-dense music that would just rip my head off. And in fact, I heard this kind of interesting tonal stuff, interesting timbral stuff, but they were folk themes, for lack of a better term. And they often had kind of simple refrains, two, three notes and things like that. And they reminded me of kind of playground music. And so the first tune I heard was Universal Indians, which is like two notes, seriously. And I thought, man, this is really interesting. So as I got into Eiler's music, and this was a pattern that would repeat itself with other musicians and other communities I looked into, I thought I would find something out about the sources, the musicological sources, the cultural sources he was investigating. But what really grabbed me was Eiler's sense, his kind of unshakable sense that while other people heard his music as, you know, quote unquote, fierce or aggressive, he and his brother Donald and their bandmates and most of their musical contemporaries really believed that they were playing universal music, that this was earth music, that they were playing the music, really conducting the music, channeling it from some other source, which is another major theme. They really believed that this was the music that gathered up all particulars, and if enough people could hear it and hear it in the right way, it would change the world. It would end war and things like this. So I thought, and then, of course, you know, they ultimately face their own commercial marginalization, many of these musicians. And so that kind of optimism and tragedy was really something that made its way into the music itself, and I found that fascinating. So Eiler really does capture an awful lot.
One of the interesting things I'm picking up on from that is this notion of universality. You know, a few weeks ago, or actually we've had a couple shows in the last couple months about African-American esotericism. And in one show, which was about a volume about the same topic that had many different, you know, articles by different contributors. And it was interesting to note that there's this tension in a lot of these figures where, on the one hand, you have people who, for very understandable historical and imaginal reasons, needed and wanted to shore up a specifically black identity or a specifically African identity in contradistinction to larger themes in American religion and American identity. And so sort of dug down and half-invented and half-rediscovered roots as a form of resistance. And simultaneously, and almost in the same milieu in many cases, you have the opposite gesture towards an almost impatient rejection of racial identity and an embrace of a language of universality, of the cosmic, of mathematics, of signs, as a way of creating sort of a transpersonal language that would enable this kind of universality. And of course, this same tension is in your book as it is in the history of jazz. On the one hand, jazz gets to carry the load in some ways, unfortunately, and sometimes in a cheesy way, of black American religion, the black church as it encounters modernity and the new urban civilization, and that whole kind of story. And of course, there's tremendous history there. It's rich. It resonates. It's remarkable. Go to Ellington, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. But at the same time, there is this drive, particularly once musicians hit the 60s and 70s, towards universality, towards abstract, towards the cosmic, which may be inflected with African elements and traditions in a number of different ways, but also has this kind of generosity or even along with a certain impatience towards the idea that jazz musicians have to carry certain historical baggage. I'm thinking here of like how Anthony Braxton in your book talks about resisting this sort of legacy of what jazz means and even turning away from the term jazz. So I'd love to hear you riff on that and perhaps talk about it in certain terms of this concept you have of the reality of this sweating brow as sort of a burden that jazz musicians have to deal with.
Yeah, it's a great term, Anthony Braxton's term. And Braxton really is kind of, I think you smartly point that out. He's sort of a pivot point, a conceptual pivot point in many ways. But it's funny. I think the first reaction I have is we would have to distinguish between different kinds of Africanisms, and that might change from period to period in the history of jazz, or it might change from performer to performer. But for the most part, I think while there is clearly going back to the 1930s and 40s all the way up into the present, but maybe peaking in the 60s and 70s, there's clearly this desire among African-American musicians to resist co-optation. And the term jazz often stands for co-optation. Think of Thelonious Monk saying it's about freedom. More than that is complicated. Think about Pete Cozy saying, don't say that. Jazz is a dirty word. There's this desire to resist. And in many ways, that involves a kind of trickster personality, the attempt to elude and evade expectations and representations using disguises and masks and so forth. But at the same time, there is an emphasis on control and self-determination, on shaping the public face of what others will call jazz. And so I think that leads to a kind of revision of what is conventionally understood by the term Africanism. Folks are reading Ben Yochanan, and they're reading all of these texts that begin to surface in the 1950s, texts about lost traditions of Egyptology, about the glories of ancient African civilizations. But they're also simultaneously, whether we're talking about Sun Ra, Charles Mingus, Archie Shepp, or Milford Graves, all folks who come to mind when I listen to you, there's a constant revision, and ultimately what we see is a resulting Africanism that is itself universal. Africa is understood as a kind of wellspring, this kind of hot historical point of creation from which all other historical trajectories emerge. So even there, in the embrace of specificity, historical and cultural and even racial specificity, there's this understanding that it always opens up beyond. And with Braxton, this idea of the reality of the sweating brow, this is used to call attention to the ways in which jazz explicitly and implicitly functions as a term of racial constraint. And, you know, Braxton and so many of his contemporaries just explode beyond jazz, even if their stuff still ends up being categorized in that way in iTunes playlists and so forth.
Right. And it also points to that tendency, or, you know, really that understandable in some ways, but also definitely racist legacy of associating, African-American performers with the body, with spontaneity, with a certain kind of naturalism, with a certain kind of labor. And while you can understand, again, why those things emerge historically and that in some cases are actually, you know, they're doing their best in a benighted situation, that really are, you know, extremely problematic, particularly if what goes along with that notion is some idea that therefore the music isn't sophisticated, or the cosmology isn't sophisticated, or all that kind of stuff, which is so, you know, kind of clearly hooey. But it does raise the question of, in a way, religion, as you're sort of using it, is not just an idea of beliefs, or an idea of cosmology, or an idea of institutional forms, churches, or even institutional forms of worship, but it's also something that is located in the body, or there is something that is moved through performance, through things that individuals do. And so what is it about the kind of, if it's not the reality of the sweating brow, that there is some kind of physicality or some kind of embodiment that's working, you know, obviously in all music, but in particular, there's something very subtle about the way that the body acts in an improvisatory context with others that seems to be very, very key to the subtle spirit that you are pointing towards.
Yeah, it's really incredible. And this is the first thing that really grabbed me about jazz as a listener, and that I sort of clamor after in my own playing, to, you know, within my limits and things like that. It's the embodiment is there, I think, on at least two levels. But the two that strike me again and again are on the level of preparation. So there's a kind of discipline, a kind of self-mastery, a kind of rigor that's necessary in order to not only gain a sort of fluency on instrument, but to, I think, lead the self into moments of receptivity and preparedness. And that obviously links us into a whole range of mystical and meditative traditions, whether they be of the self-cultivating or the self-abnegating variety. And the second level of embodiment I think of has to do with the momentariness of jazz, the immediacy of jazz, the fact that it is not, and this gets back to our opening conversation about language and category, the fact that it's not something you can plot on a map. You know, even when there's a chart, you play 8 bars, 16 bars, 32 bars, or whatever, and then you're off into at least some variant of the unknown. And that's a kind of terrifying experience as a creator, but it's also absolutely thrilling. And those are the moments, musicians attest, when they are most likely to have a kind of contact with the mysteries, however defined. And that's a moment that is, I think, bodily by definition, because all the senses are on alert. You're fully aware of your immersion in the present moment, that you have to make a decision, even if that decision is not to play, that you have to listen in a certain way to the room, to the audience, to your bandmates, to the creator, if that's the term you choose. So it's all sort of palpably there. And you're still at the same time navigating this field of constraints, representational and otherwise, that the term the reality of the sweating brow kind of denotes. So it's a fascinating exercise, I think, improvisation. And, you know, I bet you that the members of the Dead would say this, too, in a kind of different context. But improvisation is a fascinating exercise in confronting limits, confronting the inevitability of failure, and moving on, nonetheless, because you have to.
Yeah, and also there's a great phrase that's coming to my mind. I think that's the title of a psychic TV record, Forcing the Hand of Chance.
Yeah.
There's this, and what I like about that phrase, and which is has a lot of esoteric, you know, occult meanings as well as musical ones, is that it's not simply a kind of passivity. You know, there's that, I think, in a way, one of the challenges of a living spirituality, however that you want to define that term, but as an individual, as an artist or musician, et cetera, is the way to balance will and passivity. How, at what point do you just open up and something comes through? And yeah. How does that relate to practice, reason, analysis, critique, skill, et cetera, et cetera? And you talk about that as some in your book about how, you know, the some of the musicians, and your book is full of all these wonderful, wonderful phrases. I mean, you did such a great job of archiving the language that musicians have used about their work and about their ideas about religion. And just for that reason alone, it's an incredibly rich experience. And I was very interested in the people who, you know, in a way, the idea that improvisation is you got to open yourself up to the spirit and music's playing you and you're not, mm-hmm. you know, that kind of thing. In a way, that's sort of the easy part of the equation. What's harder to talk about is the force or the action, the will, the gesture, or the rationality that's still in that game. And I was very interested to see how many musicians also talked about that. They go, yeah, music's coming through, it's something larger than us, but you're still there. You know, there's still some kind of engagement there. And in that way, it becomes such a powerful analogy for, you know, for larger issues beyond the question of musical creation.
Yeah, I'm really gratified to hear you say that, because as scholars of religion, we both know how difficult it is to write against and to write through these kinds of intellectual problems that are simultaneously problems for practitioners. It's really in many ways the challenge of writing about religious experience. Yeah. So this is in many ways why I arranged the book the way that I did, going from these kind of obvious locations or articulations of religion in tradition and community and so forth, leading all the way into this kind of mysticism, selflessness stuff. But the very final case study, I wanted to really grapple with precisely what you just talked about, Eric. And that's why I chose my final case study as kind of system building. You know, folks who sort of say, okay, tradition is limited, history is limited, there's this unbelievably rich stratum of experience that we tap into when we play, but how do we give shape to that? You know, reckoning with the absolute ubiquity of language to our species and the necessity of communication, what new shapes can we give? And some musicians who and here's another thing I was astounded by, the absolutely vast range of reading and experience that we encounter among jazz musicians, who are just enormously inquisitive human beings, really remarkable and impressive. And so folks decide, okay, right, I've read all this stuff. I play for the spirits every time I play. I'm going to invent a system. I'm going to invent a metaphysic. So in some ways, that's recognizably American, you know, this kind of Whitman, Emerson, Thoreau emphasis on self-creation. But I was just stunned to see that it comes usually after a reckoning with precisely the kind of thing you just spoke about. And it comes additionally through this incredible engagement with American metaphysical traditions, which I bet 99% of jazz listeners would have no idea about prior to any kind of engagement with this material. Absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, as a student of the same current, I was blown away and extremely happy that I had that I'd already sort of done a lot of time with these musicians that I didn't really know about where they were coming from, and I was like, oh my God, of course this is just essential. It's funny. It was a musical version of the same insight that happened after I read the book on African American esotericism, which if you haven't checked out, I encourage you to do so. You'll find a lot of points of commonality. Was the recognition that up to that point, in some somewhat problematic way, I had sort of had a model of America within which one of the important kind of strands is African American religion and even its sort of esoteric things, dimensions. And then I was like, you know, actually, I kind of have to rewrite this in a more complicated way, in the sense that this stuff is not just a kind of side strand. It's like absolutely at the core, just inextricably at the core, fast moving, big muddy of American religious history and musical history, and it's the same kind of transformation when I was reading, as you said, all the books these guys are looking at. But we got to take this conversation is going to keep rolling, but we got to take a break. You're listening to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. We're talking with Jason Bivens about his great book, Spirits Rejoice, Jazz and American Religion, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis today. We're talking with Jason Bivens about Spirits Rejoice, his book on jazz and American religion. There was another point in your writing that really intrigued me, Jason, where you were talking about how, you know, it's clear the way that you can talk about states of musical experience, let's say both for musicians and listeners, you know, that tend towards the meditative or even the trancing or the ecstatic, the blissful, these sort of, you know, abstract terms for different states of consciousness, let's call it. But there's something else that's going on, and something else that runs throughout the discourse of the musicians that you've gathered. But whether or not they're thinking in terms of traditional, the influences from the traditional black church, or whether they're thinking about, you know, new age cosmic, you know, space beings and everything in between, which is that the emphasis is not just on these kinds of experiential states of trance or ecstasy, but on the presence of others, of spirits, of ghosts, of ancestors. And that shift to me seems very, very interesting and very, very perhaps a particularly specific to this jazz development of religion. Maybe, maybe not. I mean, obviously that happens in a lot of other contexts. But I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about how you came to understand the role of these others in jazz spiritual experience.
Yeah, I mean, there are a few arrows we could point. The most obvious kind of historical and cultural linkages here are to Afro-Caribbean traditions as these get transplanted to the United States and subsequently are improvised on over the course of long and painful centuries. But I think beyond that specificity, and there are other traditions, as you noted, Eric, but I think there's also a kind of fundamental sense that I got in the researching and writing of this book that perhaps, and I'm only going to say perhaps, but perhaps there's something fundamentally relational about religiosity as such, about spirituality as such. The relation will change in terms of the experience, the emotion, the expectation, the offerings that are necessary. All those things could conceivably change depending on what one is relating to. But I got the kind of clear sense that at least in thinking about this particular zone of religio music, if you want to call it that, there's something fundamentally relational about the experience, and that simply gets heightened, perhaps, in the immediacy of performance, which itself is, of course, a relational practice.
Yeah, that makes sense, and it comes in a way back to that the issue of improvisation. You know, it's as you point out, you know, one of the grand cliches of jazz discourse in America is, you know, it's the sound of democracy. You know,
right,
because you have the sort of crew, or whether it's the big band or the small ensemble, everyone's listening. Yes, there might be a leader, but it's sort of, you know, everyone gets to shine. And yeah, that's fine, whatever. But there's a kind of spiritual or religious analog or layer on top of that that takes us into a different direction that does have to do with listening, with responsibility and responsivity, and with that very strange magic of kind of mutual and collective. You could call it intuition. You could call it forcing the hand of chance. I mean, I know from my very modest experiences as an improviser, I mostly just improvise playing guitar, not for, you know, public consumption, but with friends or myself. Mm-hmm. And in these sort of humble situations, I've had the experience of people, if you will, mutually leaping into the void and discovering a sort of strange temporary landing zone that, of course, then, you know, immediately dissolves. So there's something very powerful about the sense of collective spiritual improvisation, you know, if you will, that really takes us, that actually, in a way, solves a lot of problems or avoids a lot of problems that I often find with people's approach to spirituality or people's approach to their own practice, particularly in the New Age or in the kind of alternative religious zone where the modes of collectivity and responsibility and responding are often very weak, and there's a tremendous emphasis on the self and exploring the self and the self's experience and reifying the self's experiences as a way, you know, it gets very, very narcissistic. And it seems to me that the jazz model of the collectivity of the situation and this emphasis or this opening towards the others, whether they're considered to be ghosts or spirits or a general sense of spirit, seems to push in a direction towards a more engaged and, again, collective kind of exploration.
Yeah, and it's funny too. Some of the musicians that we're referring to here, like Dennis Gonzalez, for example, a great trumpeter from the Dallas area, some folks actually begin to posit deceased jazz musicians as themselves part of this larger spiritual pantheon. And so there's this sense that when one and this again can be tied back to kind of older West African traditions of mounting and initiations, but there's this sense that in relating to the music of a particular jazz legend, if you will, that in relating to the music of, say, a Don Cherry, one is relating through that very specificity to a larger chain of ancestors, ghosts, spirits, or what have you, and in that relating to the fundamentally creative forces of the universe. So again, we come back to the interplay between will and submission, between chance and blueprint, and so and between language and abstraction. So it really is a kind of fascinating thing. But as to the collectivity issue, that I think is a really, really remarkable way of thinking about the unexpected, if I can put it that way. So, for example, in a lot of the more abstract musical settings one could listen to or play in, there are all these moments, and you kind of have to get this after the fact by talking with people, but there are always moments where people wonder, hey, did I play that or did somebody else play that? So that depends on a certain kind of, I think, reduction of instrumental specificity. You know, the horn that doesn't sound like a horn, the drum that doesn't sound like a drum, the guitar that sounds like, you know, a radiator or something like that. But there are always these experiences where you're not sure if it's you or if it's somebody else, and yet you kind of keep playing nonetheless. That's a kind of remarkable distillation of precisely the kinds of religiosity and spirituality that we're talking about abstractly.
Yeah, that makes a lot of a great deal of sense to me, and it seems to be one of the you know, different dimensions that one can discover both in listening to the music and in playing the music. I mean, we've mostly sort of been speaking kind of generally about a lot of the issues coming up, and I'm wondering, you know, we have about 10 minutes left here. Whether there are specific stories that of particular musicians that you discovered in doing the research for the book that really showed you something new about the issues going on, whether with music or whether with American religions, things that come to mind. I mean, I could throw some names out there, but it'd be interesting if there's particular stories that you really kind of carried away from the project with.
There are almost too many to think of, because the whole, if I can be indulged in saying a little something about the larger development of the book over a couple of decades, my initial thought in writing this was that I would primarily deal with the representational issues, the stuff we were talking about a short while ago with the reality of the sweating brow. So I was interested in resistance practices, you know, up until this point. Almost all of my work has been on religion and politics, so it was natural to think about resistance practices. And as I kind of dove into the history and the archives, I ended up finding all of these themes, community building, you know, intentional communities, alternate histories, and all the other things that we've talked about. And so there was this tremendous surprise that guided me, a tremendous sense of surprise that guided me at absolutely every stage of the research. And I kept finding out, I kept having experiences like the ones you mentioned earlier in our conversation. You know, hey, I knew this person's music, but I had no idea that they were into, for example, Vipassana meditation. Or I had no idea that so many people read Helena Blavatsky. So really, it was a sustained 3 years or 4 years of intensive scholarly and musical discovery for me. But if I had to pick, I think, three stories that sort of surprised me in terms of what they revealed about the individual and about the broader course of jazz and American religion, I guess I would start with Wodada Leo Smith, who is a great trumpeter and a professor of music in California. And Wodada Leo Smith has had a number of really, really suggestive and significant religious conversion experiences, all of which, during all of which, he has been working on his own system of musical metaphysics called Ankrasmation. So Wodada began as a Christian, moved into a Rosicrucian phase. Following this, he became a Rastafarian for many years, and for approximately the last 20 years, he's been a Muslim. So I found that emphasis on changing self-identification and articulations, I found that to be really, really interesting within the history of jazz, but also somehow captured something about the way Americans are constantly working on their own identity and working on their own religious identity. You know, he really kind of grabbed me in that sense.
Well, just to stay on that, I also walked away from the book with a great happiness, because since I have worked a lot on alternative religion, the so-called New Age, countercultural religion, the sort of zone of recombinant improvisation, changing, seeking, that whole zone. And, you know, of course, there's very negative discourse out there about this. Is it's cafeteria religion, it's right. Just consumerist religion. And those things are all true. They're all part of the picture, for sure. I mean, capitalism is just an extraordinarily invasive, a force. And there's no way to pretend and as soon as you think you've established any ground outside of it, you're screwed.
That's right. But
the model of the musician as the way of understanding how one moves through traditions, how one reinvents identity, how one tells a new framework, and then the framework itself begins to change the story, that it makes total sense. Like, reading about Smith, who I didn't know about at all, and then listening to some of his music and really enjoying, that was a great one of the many discoveries I had through your book. I walk away. I have no sense of this fellow being at all, whatever, you know, spineless or restless or just eating at a cafeteria. I mean, it's an absurd notion when you're looking at someone's life like this. And so, and from that, I go, well, then let's just kind of maybe stop thinking about that quite so much, or not worrying about it quite so much, when we find people who do move through these shifting religious identities with great intelligence and with great openness to the changes that those things can bring.
That's right. And there are ways of thinking about that process as a kind of musical process, right? Just as we were discussing earlier, there are ways of performing and improvising that are manifestly self-aggrandizing, that are rapacious rapacious of the musical space of others, for example, in the way that capitalism can be. But there are ways of improvising one's course through different musical and religious traditions that perform a different set of virtues, a different set of ethics. So it needn't lead one into the cafeteria direction, as you rightly say. Wadada really kind of captures all of that. And I really do hope, I'm psyched that you listen to the music. And I hope that that's really one of my great goals for this book as well, is to turn people on to this great music. I would say maybe a second story that really compelled me, among others, was going back a few chapters, the story of Charles Mingus, who a lot of people, Mingus is one of the more famous people I wrote about in the book. A lot of folks have heard about him. Mingus, because of his defiant commentary on civil rights issues in the 50s and the 1960s, Mingus has long been associated with African-American Protestantism for very specific musicological reasons, and that's very audible in his music, more audible than in Eiler's music, for example. But I was stunned on my revisiting of his autobiography, Beneath the Underdog, and by a kind of revisitation of Mingus's entire career, I was stunned to learn how consistent he had been in his practice of a kind of Hinduism. He was basically a practitioner of Vedanta from his adolescence, really. He was at least interested in it from his adolescence. He read Vivekananda's autobiography. Allen Ginsberg performed his and Sue Mingus's wedding ceremony by the banks of the Ganges. So I thought that was a really interesting flouting of a conventional historical and religious thesis about jazz music itself.
Yeah, that's remarkable. Do you know, I read the Mingus section closely because I'm very interested in California players in particular.
Yeah.
But did he go see Yogananda when he was, because it's right there, it's in L.A., right. Did he go as a young person at all? Do you know?
I'm not sure. I haven't ever come across that particular nugget, but I would be surprised if he didn't take advantage of that, because, you know, he was reading William James and Evelyn Underhill and all kinds of stuff even as a teenager. So even though I haven't found the link concretely, it would surprise me if he didn't go.
Yeah, and I got to say, too, Jimmy, you've already mentioned this, but I also was just blown away by how widely and intelligently so many of the people you talk about read. I mean, not because I didn't think they were going to be readers or whatever, yeah, but like very specific, deep currents of esotericism and yeah, moving from one thing to another. I mean, it was really kind of remarkable. Like, there's this whole other zone where esotericism in particular has been playing itself out in a particularly creative way. And I really hope that this, your book, also helps to, again, place, you know, largely African-American esotericism at the core of some of the things that we're talking about in terms of that side of American religion. Well, you know, we only have a couple minutes left, and I would actually like to hear you talk a little bit about your own improvisation and maybe even how the last 3 years have changed your sense of what you're doing, either in situ or post facto, but just a little bit about how you riff with the spirit.
Yeah, happy to do that. You know, like I was saying very briefly earlier, I've always kind of chased after weird stuff, you know, musical weird stuff in particular, because it made sense of how I felt in my own relationship with a society that continues to kind of vex me and perplex me. Subcultures were there to catch me when I was an adolescent and to encourage me to cultivate my own kind of weirdness. And when I heard jazz music for the first time because of some beautiful friends at college, I mean, really heard it for the first time, I was utterly confused by it, and I wanted to try to understand it. And the more I got involved in listening and playing and so on and so forth, the more compelled I was by those experiences of simultaneous expression and dissolution of the self. And I have to say that during the course of the research, you know, I've continued to perform and record and all this stuff the whole time, but during the course of the research, I've fallen in love with jazz all over again. But as a player, and I play in almost exclusively free improvised settings these days, as a player, I'm more and more interested in the dissolution moments, in the moments when whoever it is, whether it's a duo or whether it's a 22-person large ensemble, I like moments where I can just kind of tumble into what Keith Jarrett called the next pregnant second, and feel a kind of affective drift and a kind of suspension, a kind of loss of the chatter that kind of bedevils me and bedevils everybody all the time. Those are the moments that I chase down, and I think those are the moments that continue to compel me as a listener as well. And they can come through, I think, more obviously conventional materials as well. You get a sense that players who are doing linear stuff, doing structured stuff, can cultivate the same experiences, and I find that to be a really suggestive lesson. But it really is, I think, in achieving liftoff that I'm most interested, if that makes a kind of sense.
Yeah, yeah. It also just brings to mind, I know he was mentioned by a number of the people that you talk about in the book, but, you know, Krishnamurti's famous line that truth is a pathless land. And, you know, Krishnamurti was really quite a radical in the sense of taking the idea of seeking and then in a way taking the seeker off the path. You know, it's like you don't get a path, you get moving right through a space. And that quality that you describe, which I have also again experienced in my little minor way of stepping just slightly forward into the next moment without any sense of where the following moment's going to be, and somehow doing it in consort with others, there is a sense of how the pathless path still has steps in it, and there is something to rest on at least some of the time, and yet there's no more substance. There's no more foundation to that. And in that sense, to me, it's a profoundly mystical insight into the foundationlessness of what can still nonetheless be a path.
Yeah, very well put. And you know, listening to you just then, Eric, I think of something that Ornette Coleman's longtime colleague, the late great bassist Charlie Hayden, said, and it really, I think, clarifies some of what you were just talking about. He said, you've got to risk your life for every note, because if there's one thing you can perch on, it's that next note.
Wow. Well, we're going to have to end it there. Jason Bivens, thanks so much for joining us. This was a great conversation.
Thank you, man.
All right. So once again, Jason's book is Spirits Rejoice, jazz, and American religion. And remember, keep your minds open.